It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. So how is your city doing on fitness? The American College of Sports Medicine puts out this fitness index analyzing data from the 100 largest cities in America and ranking them based on a long list of wellness factors. The 2022 fitness index rankings are out. Madison is number 2, edging out Minneapolis. Arlington, Virginia is America's fittest city, 5 years running. So join in on community fitness, what healthy living should look like in cities, 800-642-1234. Stella Volpe is a nutritionist and exercise physiologist, a professor and head of the Department of Human Nutrition, Foods, and Exercise at Virginia Tech. She chairs the American Fitness Index Advisory Board. Stella, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Kate, thanks for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Well, here's Madison in number 2, moving up from 5th in the nation last year. What has changed?
Well, Madison has done many things, but they, you know, coming from 5 to 2, they were coming in at a good point, right? They were still great at 5, and now they're even better at 2. Some of the things they have done, for example, with health behaviors, they were number 1 in the percent of people exercising in the previous month, for example. There were 78% or almost 80% of people living in Madison sleep 7+ hours per day, which also ranked number 1. And that we know can lead to better health as well. So exercising as well as the good amount of sleep are both important for overall health. Those are just 2. I can go on and on.
Those are 2. Why rank cities based on their fitness?
Well, the American College of Sports Medicine is the world's top scientific organization on exercise and sports medicine. And 15 years ago, and I was grateful to be a part of it 15 years ago, we decided to do these rankings of cities because our mission is getting people more active. And we chose to do the top 100 cities as far as their populations because we don't have the wherewithal, right, to measure every city in the United States. But we did these with different indicators. And the overall indicators we choose are health behaviors, health outcomes, the built environment, recreational facilities, and policy and funding. And with those big headings, we have many headings underneath of these indicators that we try to measure and see how fit people are. Because getting back to your actual original question is, we know that exercise is medicine and that physical activity can lead to better health and prevention of chronic disease.
With all these indicators, how do you collect that data? Where do you get it?
Yeah, so the data are collected from the cities themselves. And I cannot take credit for the actual collecting of the data. We have people, statisticians who are excellent at doing this at the American College of Sports Medicine. And they gather these data from each of the cities, getting the data from them. Also data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So we do have national data on each of the cities that allow us to get information from the indicators we are looking for.
There's this personal health subscore and then the community environment subscore in these rankings. And, you know, the latter one, that community environment, you know, Madison was 22. What are the distinctions there in these subscores?
Yes, sure. So I'm thinking you're asking me more about the built environment, recreational facilities versus things like if I exercise.
Right. Correct. Yes. Because there are 2 separate scores there.
Absolutely. There are 2 separate scores, yet very interconnected, Kate, right? Because a person who has a greater access to being physically active will likely be more physically active. So if my built environment allows me to be more active, then the chances of me getting my 150 minutes per week that's recommended is greater than if my access to, say, a park or a trail is lower.
Okay. That makes sense. I'm going to just reintroduce you for a moment, talking with Stella Volpe, chair of the American Fitness Index Advisory Board, as we talk about cities around America, how they're doing at promoting fitness and the latest indicators. You can join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas@wpr.org. Stella, I know you have a lot of personal interest in studying obesity, for instance, and diabetes, and you score cities on just dozens of factors, as you mentioned, including the number of smokers and the money spent on parks. How do you select what indicators to study, what to suss out?
So as a committee, we first chose indicators that we knew from science, right? The evidence base that what leads to better health and what can we actually measure to that will allow us to know, are people meeting their guidelines? Are cities providing the parks, for example, for people to walk in or play in? And so as exercise scientists, we chose these indicators based on the science that we have available. And I will say, though, Kate, over the years, we've certainly, you know, changed them some and to try to make them a little bit better each time without changing them too much so that we could follow the cities year to year.
So as you look at these 100 of the largest cities and their metro areas, Madison and Milwaukee are the only Wisconsin cities listed. And you also make mention that I thought it was really interesting. You point out that rankings list the cities from highest to lowest, but the scores for many cities are very similar, you know, even though one might be 2 or 10 rankings above the other. What does that tell you?
Well, what that tells us is, especially for those top 10, that it is really tough to try to rank them. I mean, you know, it can be digits, right? It's small amounts of points that make a city number 1 versus 2 versus 10. But what it tells us is those cities are doing a great job in providing, and I keep using the word access, Kate, that is my word of the day, providing access for people to be more physically active. And that allows them, again, to have better biking paths or walking paths. Or, for example, like Madison and Arlington, where it's really easy for people to get out and go walk to go get a cup of coffee or lunch. So those top 10 are really, really all very similar and all amazing. And I also want to make sure that I say this, that whether someone's 1 or 100, there's always the ability to improve, and that the city that's 100th doesn't mean that they are doing everything poorly, but we just need to make some improvements to bring them up and to help the citizens of those cities be more active.
Virginia Tech professor Stella Volpe is a nutritionist and exercise physiologist, chairs the American Fitness Index Advisory Board. As we learn about the health and well-being of communities, get takeaways from the new Fitness Index rankings. Join in on how you score your city's culture of health and fitness. 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show. Back in a minute with Stella Volpe here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about what cities can do to help residents live a healthy and active lifestyle, how to prioritize moving over a sedentary one. The Fitness Index rankings are out. Madison in at number 2 nationwide for cities that demonstrate more resources supporting healthy living, fewer challenges to hinder it. Still time to talk about your city's fitness culture. What could help improve well-being? 800-642-1234. Stella Volpe chairs the American Fitness Index Advisory Board, and she's a professor at Virginia Tech in the Department of Human Nutrition, Foods, and Exercise. So, Stella, give us the secret to what Arlington, Virginia is doing, and why it continues just to really outshine other cities.
Yes, it's a record that they're number 1 for 5 years in a row. And one of the things that I continually talk about with Arlington, and again, as I said to you, Kate, the same with Madison, is the accessibility of parks, recreational facilities, walking trails. You know, Arlington, you know, has the river right there for rowing and kayaking, and the ability for people during their workday to be able to go out and walk and, you know, walk to lunch or walk to get a cup of coffee. Those kinds of things add up. because oftentimes when people think about exercise or physical activity, people think of, oh, I have to go run 5 miles. Whereas our physical activity guidelines establish that we can accumulate physical activity throughout the day. And that accumulation really does help with both our fitness and our health.
That's a really good point there, that we should just take a moment and acknowledge how much moderate intensity aerobic activity should we get in a day, in a week?
Sure. The physical activity guidelines state that we should accumulate 150 minutes per week. And so that really isn't a great deal of physical activity for us to then help with our prevention of chronic disease. And that those include things like gardening and walking and, you know, for people in wheelchairs, rolling, for, you know, simple things can add up. I often suggest to people that when they're watching TV during commercials, they could do sit-ups or take a little walk around their apartment or something simple that just adds up to getting those steps in per day.
Last year, you started factoring mental health into the fitness index rankings. What is the role of mental health in fitness?
Yes, we know there are strong data that indicate that physical activity, both aerobic and strength training, are effective in preventing and reducing symptoms of anxiety and depression, and also improving mood and self-esteem, and also improving our quality of sleep. In 2021, American College of Sports Medicine actually issued a statement and is offering resources on the benefits of physical activity for those with mental health issues. So there is a clear advantage that physical activity helps with mental illness.
And you had a curious thing happen around mental health, that cities that ranked in the top 25 overall tended to score well in personal health indicators, but not so in mental health. And that was the case for Madison. What's going on there?
Yeah, this was a pretty big takeaway for us this year, Kate. The poor mental health of our nation. Our American Fitness Index in 2022 provides this evidence regarding the problem scope. So on average, as you indicated, 40% of residents in the American Fitness Index cities reported poor mental health, regardless of their rankings. That was pretty much the average. And about 58% of adults in the U.S. perceived a pandemic-related negative effect on their emotional or mental health. And there's where we pinpoint it. We included mental health in our indicator actually a year ago, or, well, I guess 2 years ago. My goodness, with the pandemic, the years are going by so quickly, mm-hmm. Right?
They blur.
Right, they blur. And as a committee, we decided we wanted to do that. And what we found was we were pinpoint on noting that the pandemic really impacted people's mental health. And even though we know people who are physically active have better mental health, the pandemic certainly affected people's mental health, indicated by the high percentage of residents in cities who had reported mental health issues.
But on the flip side of that, speaking of pandemic, I mean, it was well documented by our Department of Natural Resources that people overran state parks earlier in the pandemic. They went in droves. Did that show up at all in the data? What pandemic influences there as people really got out into nature?
Yes, we did see some of that for sure. And, you know, as you know, that did happen. People were going outside more. But the one thing I want to bring up is that didn't happen in every city, because for some cities where the space is less limited or the parks, et cetera, are not as available, then you could see a decline because people were isolating more and not going out as much. So we had this really dichotomous situation happening where people could go out if they had the open space and they were exercising more, but people who didn't have that open space were isolating more. And then that would, affect their mental health, of course.
It makes me wonder about equity, of course, but about, you know, we talk about food deserts. I wonder if there are fitness deserts with a lack of community resources or ways to be healthy in particular areas. Usually, you know, this means Black and brown communities that have been devalued and underinvested in. How much did that come out in your data?
We saw some of that in our data, and I'm so grateful that you brought that up to me, because this is what really tugs at my heart, is that the clear indicator of lower access of, you know, Black and brown communities being affected more, that the communities that do not have the resources to improve certainly saw a greater effect of the pandemic, because those spaces certainly weren't getting more improved during a pandemic, right? So that part, the inequities of certain cities where trying to get people more active is more difficult, and that relates to access, it relates to safety, et cetera, that's a hard thing for us to try to, we captured it, but now we have to work on, you know, working with those cities to help policy change, to have some money go toward being people being more physically active.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about how cities approach fitness with Stella Volpe, chair of the American Fitness Index Advisory Board. You can join in with your questions or your examples of what your city is doing. 800-642-1234. Elaine from Lancaster called but couldn't stay with us, and Elaine would like to know how the arts play into the overall health of a city, and not just the mental health part, but the physical health of singing and dancing and playing an instrument. What would you say there, Stella?
Oh, Elaine, that is such a great question, because the American College of Sports Medicine, although we didn't directly measure those in these indicators, we do have an arts interest group in our American College of American College of Sports Medicine organization for just that we know that those in the arts, whether it's instruments, whether they're artists, you know, making sculptures, that they are also athletes as well. We call them artists as athletes. And so they do factor in as far as being physically active. And we take that very seriously, but unfortunately, they were not measured in our indicators, Elaine. But you're getting me thinking that I need to bring this to the committee for maybe something to perhaps for us to add for next year.
One of the things you looked at is smoking. And I'm just wondering, over the course of years, what are some indicators that have stagnated or changed or gone down? I would imagine there has been less smoking, but, you know, I don't know.
That, yes, the percent of people smoking in cities has definitely gone down. You don't see that in every city. I would say some cities have remained the same. But because of course, all the places where people cannot smoke, and many times there are cities that do not allow smoking in their parks, you will see greater declines in those cities than cities that still allow, you know, smoking in parks, for example. But you're correct. We have seen a general decline, but some cities have remained pretty similar.
What about obesity?
Well, obesity, we could be doing a little better with. We as a nation have a high percentage of obesity and overweight in our country as well as the world. The hard part with obesity is that, you know, people can still be active, but again, if they don't have access, or you talked about food deserts, and I liked how you mentioned fitness deserts. I hope I can quote you on that and use that.
All yours.
I really like that,
yours.
Kate. Thank you. it's again an inequity and issue, is that there's this sort of circular thing that happens, that people who are obese who may not have access to better foods and will not, and also less access to being active, that just sort of becomes circular. And then it's very difficult for people to lose weight. But there's positive to this. You know, the diabetes prevention program that occurred years ago showed us that people only need to lose about 5% of their body weight to have good metabolic indicators, i.e. good blood sugar and good lipid levels in their blood.
if a city could make one change today, what should they focus on? And we only have a few seconds left. What would should be the big focus?
I think the big focus should be on access. I keep using that word, but trying to give everyone access and safety with that access so that people can get out, play, walk, ride, et cetera, and just have fun and be active. And I'm just hoping that physical activity can be like brushing our teeth, right? We do it as part of our day and we don't try to fit it in. And we, if we have access, that can happen.
Stella, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. It was such a pleasure to be here. And I'm going to be in Madison in a couple of weeks to speak at University of Wisconsin. So I'm excited.
Oh, awesome. Thank you. Stella Volpe, professor, nutritionist, and exercise physiologist at Virginia Tech, founding member and chair of the American Fitness Index Advisory Board. Ahead this hour, monkeypox. We talk with an epidemiologist about what we need to know. News update and a story from Wisconsin Life are next on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with the controversial history surrounding the ice cream sundae.
Wisconsin is the home to many firsts. The first blender, the first typewriter, and even malted milk was developed and introduced to the world right here in the Dairy State. Two Rivers is the home of the first ever ice cream sundae. Well, that last one is debated by some. Dean Robbins explains.
I like driving across Wisconsin to see legendary historical sites. I've planned whole trips around the Eau Claire baseball field where Hank Aaron got his start and the Janesville house where Abraham Lincoln spent the night. But every once in a while, I stumble across a bit of Wisconsin history I knew nothing about. That happened on a recent drive through the northeast part of the state when I pulled into Two Rivers. In Central Park, I noticed an official Wisconsin historical marker claiming it as the birthplace of the ice cream sundae. Coincidentally, my favorite dessert. Could such a major phenomenon have originated in this small town? According to the marker, a local man named George Hallauer walked into a soda fountain on 15th Street in 1881. He asked owner Edward Berner to top a dish of ice cream with chocolate sauce, a substance previously reserved for ice cream sodas. The new concoction caught on, and Berner began selling it for a nickel, but only on Sundays. Enter a 10-year-old girl who insisted on having a dish of ice cream with that stuff on top on a different day of the week. That was out of the question for Berner, until the girl charmingly suggested that they pretend it was Sunday. That opened the floodgates, with the shopkeeper offering the dish every day in many flavors. The unusual spelling of Sunday started when a salesman placed an order for Berner's canoe-shaped dishes with his glassware company. He requested Sunday dishes with an E at the end rather than a Y, and the rest is history, or so says the state of Wisconsin. Is this amazing story for real? Standing there in Central Park, I searched for ice cream sundae origin on my phone. Sure enough, Two Rivers has rivals to the claim. The most aggressive challenger is Ithaca, New York, which points to a 19th century newspaper ad for a locally served sundae. In a New York Times article on the dispute, Ithaca's mayor sneered at Two Rivers, saying, "We have the historical documents, and they don't." Two Rivers refused to take that lying down. The city passed a resolution demanding that Ithaca cease and desist with its Sunday slanders. Residents also deluged Ithaca's mayor with postcards picturing the Wisconsin historical marker. On matters of milk fat, Ithaca surely learned that you crossed the Dairy State at your peril. So what's the truth? To gather crucial evidence, I strolled to the Two Rivers Visitor Center in an 1850s inn. You can bet the complex houses a soda fountain, named after local hero Edward Berner. Purely for the sake of historical research, I ordered an ice cream sundae. Was it a descendant of the world's first sundae, served here in 1881? Sorry, Ithaca, but I have no documentation. All I'll say is that, with its thick chocolate sauce, overflowing whipped cream, and juicy cherry, the dish made me a believer.
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. He's won state and national awards for arts, features, and news stories, and has contributed to magazines and newspapers around the country. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
It is the morning show. I'm Kay Darcher Kent. Now, the CDC is closely tracking cases of monkeypox recently detected in the U.S. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's case count map, it shows more than 1,400 cases of monkeypox nationwide. That's this morning, reported in 42 states, including Wisconsin. Join in on this rare disease caused by infection with the monkeypox virus, 800-642-1234. Michael Osterholm is here, professor and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He's an international leader in the field of epidemiology. Michael Osterholm, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's great to be back with you.
What makes monkeypox a concern for public health officials versus other infectious diseases circulating in the community?
Well, first of all, it is clearly a new type of disease for the world. This has been a virus that has existed dating back to probably the earliest human history in Africa, in at least 11 countries there. It's a virus that is a relative to the old smallpox virus, which now has been eradicated or no longer on the face of the earth in a naturally occurring way. And the reason monkeypox was not eradicated was because it actually has an animal reservoir, meaning that in those Central African countries, it actually is also infecting rodents. And what's happened is really kind of a story right out of history, is that the smallpox eradication program, the effort to eliminate smallpox from the world, meant that we vaccinated people against smallpox up until the 1980s worldwide. And with that vaccination, not only did you get protection against smallpox, but also against monkeypox. Mm. Now, fast forward almost 40 years, and we have not used a smallpox vaccine in Central Africa, and you have over 327 million people who weren't born in 1980 who now live in those countries. They, in turn, have gotten infected from contact with these animals, and that, in turn, then led to this epidemic we see now worldwide, in which it's now gotten into men who have sex with men, who have many partners, a number of them anonymous, and that has resulted in a type of transmission that we had not seen before.
Does it spread as easily as COVID-19? Can you give us any comparisons of what we know?
Yeah. not even close.
Okay.
COVID-19 is spread via the air and highly infectious. This virus so far has largely been what we would consider to be a sexually transmitted infection. Clearly, contact can result in transmission. So think of it like the other ulcerative diseases we think of with sexually transmitted infections, syphilis, chancroid, herpes, those kinds of illnesses where you actually get in contact with the vesicle or the open lesion, and that's what transmits the virus. And so far, that appears to be very much the case with what we're seeing here. The challenge we have is we actually have an effective vaccine that can be used today against monkeypox. It's just we have very little of it. And so the ability to get vaccine to all those that should have it is going to be a real challenge over the months ahead, and it's going to lead to a lot of frustration. There are a lot of people who will want to be vaccinated who won't be able to get vaccinated just because even making the vaccine as quickly as we possibly can, it will not be quick enough.
How does monkeypox affect people? What are symptoms like?
Well, the good news also is that it has largely been a relatively mild illness with these vesicles you see on people or like little blisters. And they've most often occurred in areas of the body where there has been contact, what we call the perianal region, the genital region. Some of the lesions have been across the entire body, but these people in general have not been that sick. We've had 3 deaths so far in all the cases we're aware of outside of Africa. It is surely a potential challenge for those who are immune compromised. And as you know, the overlap with HIV infection and men who have sex with men is a real concern. Now, fortunately, many of these people are already on HIV-related drugs to help them from becoming seriously ill with HIV, which means that they still have some good protection against monkeypox. So on a whole, the good news is that this is not nearly as infectious as COVID. It's not nearly as deadly as COVID or as HIV. And so what we're really trying to do is deal with an outbreak that we don't want it to spread further. We don't want to have those cases that do occur occasionally that could be severe illness.
As you look at the CDC maps, the U.S., the world, do you see hot spots? What are you seeing there?
You know, this virus is just going to transmit around the world, much as we saw in the early days of HIV. Again, it's not because of HIV, but it's when you have individuals who are having a number of anonymous sex partners, multiple partners, new partners, that leads to the transmission of the virus and the spread around the world. And for many sexually transmitted infections, you're able to actually track down in the context of an individual who might have had that particular infection and then treat them accordingly. Well, unfortunately, a number of the individuals in the earliest days of the monkeypox transmission didn't know who their contacts were. They were anonymous. And so, again, we're really left with trying to get the message out as much as we can to men who have sex with men in particular. Now we're going to start to see spillover. I don't want to leave you with the idea that this is going to be exclusively an illness of men who have sex with men. We've already are seeing cases where we have bisexual men who are having sex with women, who in turn they get infected. So this is going to, in a sense, leak out of that environment of men having sex with men. But it's not going to be widespread. It's not going to be a challenge. And for example, men who have sex with men who are in committed relationships or are not having multiple partners really have no greater risk than does a heterosexual for contracting this infection.
There are concerns in the LGBTQ plus community that a disease that's primarily striking gay and bisexual men could lead to the same kind of blame and stigma that we have seen in the past with HIV and AIDS. What do you think of that stigma?
Well, I think that's actually a very important point and one that we can't ignore. On the other hand, as public health experts, our job is to tell people exactly who's at risk, what puts them at risk, and what they can do to reduce that risk. And so not directly and very specifically laying out the information we know about who's at risk and what they can do to reduce that risk means we're not doing our job. And so we have to be mindful at all times about the stigmatization. I understand that. I was very involved with the earliest days of HIV/AIDS. I saw it front and center. I experienced it front and center in our communities. But at the same time, ignoring or not elaborating on what you can do to protect yourself against this particular virus is public health not doing its job.
Veteran epidemiologist Michael Osterholm with us at the University of Minnesota, fielding questions about monkeypox and what public health leaders are watching for and planning for. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show with Michael Osterholm here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The journal Science posed this question recently about monkeypox. Why is a virus that has never managed to spread beyond a few cases outside Africa suddenly causing such a big global outbreak? Global confirmed cases, CDC's map showing over 11,000 cases. Now we're getting up to speed with a longtime epidemiologist. Join in on the monkeypox outbreak, the spread, the risk of stigma, 800-642-1234. Michael Osterholm directs the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Stays with us. So you mentioned if we have this limited vaccine supply in the world, who would be eligible then to get a monkeypox vaccine?
Well, first of all, Kate, it is going to be a very difficult situation in the weeks and months ahead just because of the shortage of the vaccine. First of all, to take a step back and just remember why we even have the vaccine at all. It largely was from the year 2000 until recently a stockpile of vaccines should someone ever use smallpox. And of course, that concern was actually raised with Ukraine and the fact that the Russians and the United States still have stocks of smallpox virus. So there was always attention paid to the fact that we needed to keep vaccine around just in case this horrible, horrible scenario should unfold of someone using smallpox. But then in addition, we kind of forgot about the historic nature of monkeypox. And what I mean by that is that we've known for years that eventually the population-based protection against monkeypox would wear off in that we would have many, many people born since we stopped using smallpox vaccine, which again, as I mentioned before, does protect also against monkeypox, and that you would have this very susceptible population. So think about this. In the last 40 years, more than 327 million people have been born now reside in those 11 countries in Central Africa where this virus, unlike smallpox, which was only in humans, this virus is also in certain animal species. So the spillovers from animals to humans just continued to grow in number. And in fact, in 2003, we had a spillover that involved people right here in southern Wisconsin, where we actually had animals that were brought in for sale in pet stores from Africa, that gerbils, a type of rodent, that actually were in a large animal shipping warehouse where they then had relative contact to prairie dogs that were also being sold in pet stores. And the prairie dogs got infected from the gerbils and the other animals brought in. And we had an epidemic of monkeypox in a very famous case in Rockford, Illinois, of a young woman who was hospitalized there. And so this is not new, but what's happening now is the world has not had any vaccine against smallpox, so the whole world's vulnerable. So once it started spreading out of Central Africa, it quickly went into a world that for the last 40 years has had virtually no protection afforded to it against monkeypox by vaccination.
So if the country's monkeypox outbreak expands, do you see that hospitals, other clinics, clinicians have access to enough tests and other tools to help contain the spread?
I don't, and that's my concern. Actually, you mentioned in the lead in about an article in Science on this issue. Mm-hmm. I actually have an editorial coming out in Science in the next day or two on this very issue, in which I lay out the challenges and the fact that we are going to continue to see spread because we don't have enough vaccine. And so our first and most important message is going to be we have got to educate that at-risk community to say, you know, you need to know that you are at risk for monkeypox. And when you asked me the other question earlier about stigmatizing gay men, you know, how are we accomplishing both? Letting, you know, the gay community know what are the risk factors for this virus to spread and occasionally leak out from even the gay community, and specifically among those who are having these higher risk exposures. Remember, not all gay men are having that. So I want to be really clear about that. But we've got to help that group understand if you wear condoms, you don't have contact with someone who is has these vesicles on them, that will help a lot. But in the meantime, we're going to have to try to use the vaccine the best we can. And I will predict right now there will be major frustrations. There will be anger in the gay community because of their inability to get the vaccine. Why do we not have more? Because we no one ever really anticipated this kind of event happening where we'd have to vaccinate lots and lots of people against monkeypox. Should we have anticipated? Absolutely we should have. We knew for the last 40 years that eventually we would see more spillovers from Africa just by the nature of the growing population who are at risk. I think the final piece is we have got to now reinitiate a major campaign in Central Africa to help vaccinate these 327 million people, or we're going to keep seeing these spillover events. So literally monkeypox vaccination should become a part of the everyday vaccine picture that young kids in Central Africa have the opportunity to be vaccinated with.
Before we move on to the new dominant Omicron strain, I'm just going to reintroduce you here, Michael Osterholm, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Just a little briefly here, BA5 driving up cases and reinfections, what are you seeing?
Well, as I've shared with you before, Kate, on this very show, you know, this virus just continues to throw 210-mile-an-hour curveballs at us. You know, who would have imagined when Omicron first emerged last December that it would not just be that variant, as we'd seen before with alpha and beta and gamma and delta, all variants, but now we're talking about subvariants. And what we're now talking about is BA1, BA2, BA2.12. I mean, we now have BA4, BA5, and these subvariants are presenting real challenge. For example, even those who are infected with BA1 in December and January are now vulnerable to BA5 because of the immune evasion of that particular strain of the virus now means that the protection you might have had from your immune system's response to the original infection isn't working sufficiently to keep you from getting infected. So I think the challenge we have right now is, what will BA5 do? How much immune evasion? If you've had 4 doses of vaccine, does it mean you still get infected? Well, it does. Right now we're seeing lots of infections in people who even had 4 doses. But the good news is it surely appears at this point that it's reducing the likelihood of having severe illness. So that's why, you know, I still am very strongly supportive of being fully vaccinated. It's just you have to expect the fact that it doesn't mean it's going to stop transmission.
There are reports that more people are contracting the virus multiple times in relatively like quick succession. What could that indicate?
Well, this is all about the immune evasion of this virus. Every time it mutates, it changes in a way that the previous exposure to either vaccine or to the natural infection itself before meant that the immunity that you had as a result of that is not sufficient to cover these new mutations that are changing with this virus. Mm. And that's a real challenge. Now, the unknown that is really a concern is, so what does that mean? Well, if you look at countries like South Africa, where they saw an initial BA1, the original Omicron strain, emerge, and then they saw BA5 emerge, they only saw limited increase in number of new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. Now, there may be other reasons for this, but if you look at countries like Portugal, where they have a number of people vaccinated that exceeds anything we've done in this country, and they actually saw BA5 create a peak in cases, both serious illness, hospitalizations, and deaths, equal to their original Omicron surge that they saw late last winter. Mm. And so one of the challenges we have right now is trying to anticipate what's going to happen. You know, we're at about 430 to 450 deaths a day now in this country, which, you know, is 3,000 plus deaths every week. Is that going to continue to grow? Will we get to the point of several thousand deaths a day, as we've seen with the peak activity with Omicron and Delta? We don't know. At this point, all I can say is that we, as scientists, have to be honest with the public and say what we know and what we don't know. And yeah, I got to tell you, we don't know what BA5 is ultimately going to do. And then on top of that, I don't know what's next. Is it BA7? Is it BA8? Is it Pi or Sigma, brand new variants? And this is the challenge of COVID. We as a society are done with COVID. We're done. Mm. But the virus isn't done with us.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Osterholm, professor and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.